I'm Chris Sturr. Next on Unwelcome Guests, Deadly Embrace, Nicaragua, the World Bank, and the IMF. A video which documents the devastating effects the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have had on Nicaragua. The documentary begins with Peter Schumann of Bread and Puppet Theater reading an excerpt from senior economist Davison Budhoo's letter of resignation from the IMF. Budhoo resigned from the IMF after working there for 12 years. His 100-page letter of resignation documents statistical fraud carried out by the fund and condemns its creation of poverty in countries like Nicaragua.
Today, I resign from the staff of the International Monetary Fund after 12 years and after 1,000 days
I consider that there's no comparison to the economic crisis that Nicaragua is going through right now.
Blanca Obando Fonseca.
I've lived under three governments. Even under the dictatorship of Somoza, where there were problems, at least there was work and I went to school. Under the Sandinista government, there was a war and there was a blockade, but there wasn't hunger. We were never without rice and beans. But now, even with my husband, Daniel, working, we have passed times without being able to eat.
In the 1980s, the policies of the government.
Francisco Campbell, President, University of the Autonomous Regions.
Were implemented in such a way that while people did not have a lot of luxury, they at least had a job. So when we talk about 60% unemployment nationally and 90% unemployment on the Caribbean coast, we are saying that the World Bank, the IMF, in collusion with the central government of Nicaragua, are the culprits.
Jan Piercy, U.S. Executive Director of the World Bank.
The goals of the World Bank are to eliminate poverty through achieving, in partnership with member governments, sustainable economic development.
World Bank and IMF promotional material.
The World Bank is actually an international development organization.
Its role is to lend money to the governments of its poorer members, often called developing countries.
This money is used to increase economic productivity and to improve the standard of living of people in these countries.
Since its inception, the IMF has sought to help its members grow economically. Such growth, the product of an international system of free trade working to benefit all people, has been nurtured as the fund's member countries have used the institution in imaginative and flexible ways. For over 40 years, the International Monetary Fund, in the spirit of Bretton Woods, has met the need of an ever-changing world.
The bank has been about this work now for 50 years, coming out of the end of World War II, when it was understood that unless we achieved equitable development around the world, the conditions that create conflict and war would continue and lead to additional conflict.
Newsreel of the founding of the World Bank and IMF, Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, 1944.
United States Treasury Secretary Morgenthau heads the American delegation. On the opening day, in his role of acting conference president, he addresses the meeting. To be discussed are plans for the stabilization of world currencies. All agreements must be ratified by the governing bodies of the nations involved before becoming effective.
You have to take into account who these organizations serve.
Francisco Campbell.
These organizations were never intended to help poor countries of the world. These organizations were created to strengthen the recovery of the economies of Europe, fundamentally, and of course, the United States. In that respect, I would have to say they are doing a good job.
The United States gives a quota each year of money to the International Monetary Fund and to the World Bank as a member.
Sharon Hostetler, author of Bitter Medicine.
And because it has 17% of the vote, that means that the United States has tremendous influence. A lot of that money is used to make low-interest loans to these governments so that they can pay the debt to the banks on Wall Street, to the banks in London. So my tax dollars, in fact, are not necessarily going to a development project in Nicaragua. They might end up at one of the banks on Wall Street.
Javier Armando Zamora.
Look, I don't have any money. My pockets are empty. I'm not embarrassed that I don't have any money. Where am I going to find it when this country keeps getting more and more in debt? Each Nicaraguan now owes $3,000 to $4,000 to foreign creditors. What is it like for Nicaraguans not to have any money in their pockets? Where can we get this money?
Nicaragua's debt is known as the highest per capita debt in the world. In the late 60s, early 70s, the OPEC nations had a lot of money from oil that they were putting into banks. So banks had a glut of money, so they went traveling around Latin America and offering this money to dictators. They didn't do their homework necessarily to see, well, are they going to use this money responsibly? But they poured millions and millions of dollars into Latin American governments in loans.
Every day, Nicaragua pays almost $1 million in debt service to its creditors. In 1998, because of Hurricane Mitch, a short-term moratorium on the repayments was made. However, interest will continue to accrue, increasing the total debt.
If we carry on servicing this incredible debt,
economist Javier Gorostiaga, President, University of Central America.
Nicaragua never will recover a normal economy because the external debt is paralyzing the economy and is polarizing the country, because the external debt is one of the main causes why Nicaragua has 60% of unemployment and why Nicaragua over 70% of the total population is under poverty level. Nicaragua started the negotiations with the IMF and the World Bank in order to sign the agreements of the structural adjustment just after the victory of Doña Violeta. The first agreement was signed around 1991, and the debt goes on increasing and polarizing this country.
The overwhelming issue, the overriding issue, has become structural adjustment policies pushed by both institutions across the South and Eastern Europe.
Doug Hellinger of Development Gap and former World Bank employee.
Structural adjustment grew out of the debt crisis of the late 70s and the early 80s. And at first, adjustment was aimed at squeezing every last dollar or peso out of these countries. So you would have austerity, so you'd cut budgets and you'd squeeze credit. And with that money that you save, you would pay off your debt. and banks wanted their money back. So it was serving commercial lenders. But then the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund learned that you could open up economies in this way too, to direct investors and to financial and portfolio investors. And you could use cheap labor and you could get around the type of environmental restrictions that are home here in the States and in Europe. So that's really what adjustment has become, at the expense of the poor.
Between 1996 and 1998, the World Bank made an income from loans of $22 billion off of interest payments and fees from developing countries.
The rationale behind structural adjustment,
Jan Piercy, U.S. Executive Director of the World Bank,
is to put governments and economies, national economies, on a footing which will enable the country to effectively participate in a global economy and to create conditions in which, for example, rampant inflation are brought down so that people can count on a stability in an economy in which their labor and their efforts can result in an income that can provide for themselves and their families.
6 million children die each year in Latin America, Asia, and Africa due to IMF and World Bank imposed structural adjustment policies, according to the United Nations. Structural adjustment policies insist on restriction of credit, lowering tariffs and opening markets, balancing the country's budget, low wages, privatization of state industries, and repayment of the national debt. In Nicaragua, restriction of credit has meant no loans to farmers. Lowering tariffs and opening markets has meant that cheap imports flood the marketplace. Balancing the country's budget has meant that education, welfare, health care are slashed and the military budget is increased. Low wages have meant 63 cents per hour in Nicaragua. And privatization of state industries and repayment of the national debt have meant economic devastation for the Nicaraguan people.
Mi padre es un campesino, muy humilde. Él no sabía leer ni escribir.
Victor Martinez.
My father was a small farmer, a humble man. He didn't know how to read or write. During my father's time, we didn't have much, so I wasn't able to go to school. At that time, you could get by a little easier, because my father told me that if he planted one measure of beans, he would harvest 40. The lands were fertile. Today, it's not that way. If you don't use fertilizer, you don't have a harvest. And from 1990 on, we were no longer given loans to prepare our fields. For the small producer, there just aren't any. If you can't get a loan, you can't afford fertilizer, and you don't have any harvest at all.
Structural adjustment in Nicaragua has meant a general cutting of funds available for credit to farmers.
Sikles Robinson, editor, Nicaraguan Farmers View.
Within the priorities of the Nicaraguan government, the money that has been available has been channeled mainly to large farmers, although even the large farmers would complain about the levels of credit that they've had. The tendency in the country, supposedly, under the structural adjustment agreements, is to increase exports. But the money, the investment money, has not been made available to be able to do that. So you have a contradiction. At the same time, you have the world, in economic terms, telling everyone, you've got to be efficient and you've got to be competitive. But farmers in Nicaragua didn't have the same period of time that farmers in Europe and North America did, where over decades, they became more economically efficient and more productive. And they had lots of subsidies and lots of financing from their governments to do that. Nicaragua comes out of a war. Suddenly they wanted the farmers to be efficient and competitive, but there's no money for investment, and that's a direct result of structural adjustment.
In 1998, Nicaragua's unemployment rate was 25.1%. In 1998, it was 53.3%.
Yo tenía una venta bastante surtida. Buen abastecimiento tenía.
Before 1990, I had a very well-stocked store with a variety of goods.
Julian Gaitan.
From 1990 to 1995, I have seen a decrease in business here in the store. There are many things we cannot buy, and we see that many businesses are experiencing the same crisis. A crisis which is related to the economic situation here in Nicaragua, because the consumer doesn't have work and earns very little. So we sell very little, and we are getting poor because we don't have the means to overcome the situation.
También nosotros nos empobrecemos porque no tenemos cómo superar esta situación.
According to Oxfam, only 6,000 of some 40,000 small businesses that existed 10 years ago in Nicaragua survive today.
We have seen tremendously destructive measures in countries from Nicaragua to Zimbabwe to the Philippines.
Doug Hellinger.
People being made to pay the price. People had nothing to do with the debt. People have nothing, have no gain whatsoever from opening the economy. We have seen small businesses wiped out, small farms wiped out. They can't get credit. They can't get technical assistance. Cheap imports are coming into the country. These imports are destroying these small enterprises. Wages are going down. This is particularly the case in a country like Nicaragua, a small country like Nicaragua.
Excerpts from ads for the World Bank. The World Bank is just what it says it is, a bank that invests in the world. It doesn't just lend money, it helps developing countries become tomorrow's markets. How do you get more bang for your buck? Ask the World Bank. The World Bank is just that, a bank that invests in the world, and the benefits for America are remarkable. The World Bank helps create new markets in developing countries, and thus new opportunities for Americans to sell their goods. 40 years ago, our best customers lived across town. Today, they're around the world. The World Bank, a good investment.
I always hear people say on the street, before, during the Sandinista times, there was war, but there was never hunger.
Blanca Obando Fonseca.
Now, there is no war, and there is hunger. No matter what house you might visit, there is nothing to eat, because people don't have jobs. As a woman, the economic crisis affects me greatly. I am in the house all day. I clean, I wash, I cook. I worry about not having enough money for health care for my sick baby Nora, about not having enough money for shoes for my eldest. I worry because I can't afford the food and the textbooks that are necessary.
From World Bank promotional material.
Most World Bank loans are for specific development projects. They may help farmers to grow more and better crops and to earn more income from them, help to set up small businesses, or to provide health care, housing and education to people in rural areas as well as in towns and cities.
The International Monetary Fund says to Nicaragua, you have to balance your budget.
Sharon Hostetler, author of Bitter Medicine.
The government had to cut social programs, and they did so to the tune of 50%. As unemployment rises, health care, education, welfare services decrease dramatically. So that has affected the urban population immensely.
In the 1980s, education was free in Nicaragua. In 1999, one quarter of all children were not able to attend school because they could not afford to pay the tuition that schools now require. Voices from Managua's recent teachers' strike.
¿Por ¿Por qué me llevan si solo he venido a protestar por mi salario, nada más?
Why are they taking me away? I'm only protesting my salary, nothing more.
La demanda del Magisterio Nacional, digamos, son...
There are four general aspects to the teacher's demands. The first has to do with salary.
José Antonio Cepeda, Executive Committee Member, Anden Teachers Union.
Currently, the average salary of a primary school teacher is $60 a month. And the average salary of a secondary school teacher is $70 a month, which in the present situation really is not enough to cover the basic needs of daily life. Since 1990, over 4,500 teachers have been laid off as a result of the policies imposed by the IMF and the World Bank. These policies have resulted in the closings of schools, the cutting of special programs such as literacy, adult education, and bilingual intercultural programs on the Atlantic coast. Also, the schools are now charging tuition. This has meant the reduction of the number of students who have access to education.
Due to structural adjustments, in 1995, the budget for higher education was cut 6% in violation of Nicaragua's constitution. Sounds of student protests. 35 people were shot. A professor and a student were killed.
To me.
Peter Schumann of Bread and Puppet Theater reads an excerpt from senior economist Davison Budhu's letter of resignation from the IMF.
Resignation is a priceless liberation. For this end, I have taken the first big step to that place where I may hope to wash my hands of what in my mind's eye is the blood of millions of poor and starving peoples.
Because I could not find work here in Nicaragua, I couldn't feed my children.
Carmen Jarjín.
So I went to Costa Rica while the girls stayed with my mother. I was working there for a few months, then I returned to Nicaragua in December. I came back here to be with my girls and to look for work. I am still unemployed, and I am very worried because I am alone and I have to take care of my children. A lot of my neighbors said there was work at the free trade zone, so I went there for a week. Every day I went at 5 in the morning until 12 in the afternoon. There were huge lines of people waiting beneath the hot sun. Then this man came out and said to us, "Come back tomorrow." Everyone came back the next day, and the exact same thing happened.
One of the pieces of structural adjustment is that you need to bring investment into your country, foreign investment.
Sharon Hostetler, author of Bitter Medicine.
So governments are very willing to set up what they call free trade zones, where they will give huge tax cuts to these foreign investors who will come in and set up a factory in Nicaragua, for example, in Costa Rica, in Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala. All of these countries need this investment so badly that they're even willing to let these investment people know that they can come in and get around the labor code, which means in the free trade zone out here by the airport, labor unions are not allowed to organize. Most of the folks who work in the free trade zones are young women. And most of these women do not complain about the conditions because the owners will say, you don't like it? There are 1,000 women outside the gates looking for a job. We'll see someone else in your place tomorrow. So I think it's that kind of pressure as literally treating people almost as slaves. But the government is willing to do that because of these agreements which prioritize foreign investment.
The government is trying to increase the amount of space and opportunities for Zona Franca because they are a way to create jobs.
José Evanor Taboada Arana, President, Central Bank of Nicaragua.
We could say that in some cases the jobs are not well paid, as you can hear from part of the population. Unfortunately, right now the options is either we have jobs not well paid or not job at all.
From an ad for Nicaragua's free trade zone. Reason to choose Nicaragua, average salary including benefits, 63 cents per hour and a 48-hour work week. Corporations in the free trade zone in Nicaragua include Bill Blass, Gap, Guess, Jordache, Perry Ellis, Ralph Lauren, Casual Corner, Lacoste, Sears, Kmart, Walmart, DuPont. From an ad for Haitian free trade zones, unions non-existent. From an ad for the Salvadoran free trade zone, you can hire Rosa Martinez for 57 cents an hour. Rosa is more than just colorful. She and her coworkers are known for their industriousness, reliability, and quick learning.
The Fortune 500 corporations want to go global. They want as few restrictions as possible on the movement of their capital.
Doug Hellinger.
So that's really what adjustment has become. And I think we have to look at it in that way. If we don't understand what's behind this, who's interested behind it, adjustment makes no sense because it is failing so miserably. It is destroying the productive capacity of countries. Nicaragua is a perfect example. We're destroying community, we're destroying family, we're destroying whole economies, and we know better.
Seek, which numbers actually 2,200 groups across the country in different campuses, has begun a divestment program in universities. It's begun with a pilot at Boulder, Colorado, where the university administration holds just over $2 million worth of bonds.
Danny Kennedy, Student Environmental Action Coalition and the 50 Years is Enough Network, at a meeting with Jan Piercy, U.S. Executive Director of the World Bank.
And the students there have started petitioning and will escalate their tactics until they have to do block-ins or do whatever they need to get that university administration to divest those funds. Once that works, we will replicate that across the country throughout our networks until it sends sufficient political signal to you and sufficiently muddies your reputation in this country.
You can hold me individually accountable, but you have to understand I'm one of 24 executive directors and that I am directed by the U.S. government on the vote that I cast. And I'm not saying this to hold myself any less accountable, but only for you to understand the levers of change.
I bring greetings from the Philippines, especially to the Philippine delegation.
Professor Leonor Briones, Freedom from Debt Coalition, Philippines.
To remind them that 39 million Filipinos live in absolute poverty, that 109,000 children die before reaching the age of 5, because there is no money to pay for health, but enough money to pay the debts to the World Bank and the IMF.
For the first time, the world is a global village.
Economist Javier Gorostiaga, President, University of Central America.
For the first time, Nicaraguan people, Nicaraguan economies know what has been happening in Africa, know what has been happening in other Latin American countries. We know the failure, the substantial failure of these policies. Basically, the IMF and the World Bank and the regional banks like the Inter-American Development Bank are controlled by the United States or by the group of seven big nations in the world. If we don't democratize these financial institutions, I will say that this failure that we had in the last 50 years in the development policies will continue.
In Asia, in the Pacific, in Latin America, in Africa, people are saying in factories, they're governing in farms, they're talking in urban shelters, they're praying in the churches, and they're all saying 50 years is enough. World Bank, IMF, out.
Deadly Embrace was produced by Elizabeth Canner and Ashley Eames, and directed by Elizabeth Canner. It was adapted for radio by Chris Sturr. Next on Unwelcome Guests, we'll hear the audio from Something to Hide, a video released last year by the National Labor Committee. The NLC is a small organization in New York City which has been at the forefront of the anti-sweatshop movement. This documentary follows a delegation of students from North American universities who travel to El Salvador with Charlie Kernaghan of the NLC to inspect conditions at the factories where college apparel is made.
3 years ago, there was no anti-sweatshop movement in the U.S. Today, there is. Made up of labor, religious, student, and community organizations, there is a growing social movement to end sweatshop abuses and child labor. Organized through the United Students Against Sweatshops, students on over 150 college campuses across the country are playing a key role. After the violent civil war in the 1980s, which devastated El Salvador, multinational corporations moved in, setting up production in huge free trade zones where they pay no taxes. The conditions in these maquila factories are hidden from public inspection. Students from the University of Arkansas, Kentucky, Wisconsin, Yale, Middlebury, and Grinnell, along with representatives from the National Labor Committee, arrived in El Salvador in August. They loaded into a bus and began crisscrossing the country, meeting with workers, union leaders, and human rights groups, and trying to get into factories to see the conditions firsthand.
In El Salvador today, there are approximately 225 factories.
Charlie Kernaghan of the National Labor Committee.
70,000, mostly young women, assembling 581 million garments a year for export to the United States. The maquila is booming. In fact, the presidents of the country said, we're going to make El Salvador one giant free trade zone. You no longer have to be inside the free trade zones to get tax-free production. You can be anywhere in the country.
The delegation met a worker named Sonia, who lives in a squatter's neighborhood on the outskirts of San Salvador. She was fired from the Duol factory, where she sewed Liz Claiborne clothing, for speaking with a commission of students from Columbia University about the factory conditions.
My name is Sonia Beatriz. Tengo 23 años.
My name is Sonia Beatriz. I am 23 years old. I have a 5-year-old daughter. I started working in the factories in 1994. When I began to work, we had to start at 10 minutes to 7, and if you arrived late, they deducted a half hour from your pay. They didn't give us breaks. We went home at 7 at night. At times, we worked until 10:30 every night. On Saturday, we worked until 7. And on Sundays, we worked until 5 in the afternoon. When we didn't work on Sundays, we worked all night Saturday. You couldn't say anything about the extra hours. You had to work. It was obligatory. And if you said you couldn't stay, they punish you or they chastise you. But we're humans. We are not machines.
What the multinationals have essentially done, they roam the world in search of the lowest wages, the least benefits. They look for places where there are no implementation of human or worker rights, no occupational health and safety, no taxes, no regulations, no red tape. They go into these countries and they set up production and they put their arms around very young women. That's who they want in the factories. So almost invariably, country after country, the workforce is 17 or 16 to 25 years of age. The women come into these factories with little formal education and they don't know their rights. They don't know the Salvadoran Labor Code. They never heard of Kathy Lee. They never heard of Walmart. They've never heard of the corporations which they ultimately work for. They're pulled into the global economy really with no tools to defend themselves. And when they try to learn their rights, they're fired.
Would you like to have a union?
Yes, we would like it, because a group of people speaking to the Korean managers could tell them what we think. That we would like to be treated a certain way. We would like our rights as workers. But if only one or two people go to speak to them and ask for this or that, they don't pay attention.
Then to come down here and to talk to 22 and 23-year-old maquila workers who identify with us, and we identify with them, reinforced for me that, you know, everything that we've been talking about in the past year is totally in tandem with what these workers are talking about. And it's because of these delegations, it's because of these trips, that we're able to create real solidarity between workers here and students and consumers and working people in the States.
There's so many complaints that students, you know, in the 90s are so apathetic, Generation X. They don't care about anything. It's all about materialism, and it's not true. It's not true.
All of the free trade zones look like armed camps or prisons. They are surrounded by concrete walls, barbed wire, and guards with guns. Anytime someone from the outside tries to see the conditions under which the clothes are made, they are not allowed in or are promptly chased out.
Because we work for Nike and Adidas, they really want us to get everything clear through them.
Here are the internal documents for Nike. When they go offshore, they list every single operation involved in making a Nike shirt. Every step is listed. And next to every single step, there's what they call SAMs, standard allotted minutes. They break the timing down into hundredths of a second. The workers get 6.5 minutes to make the shirt. Everything, from beginning to end. 6.5 minutes at 60 cents an hour is 7 cents. In this Nike shirt, which sells for $22.99, there is 7 cents of labor.
The minimum wage in El Salvador is 60 cents an hour. Although it meets less than one-third of the cost of living, the factory owners are threatening to slash the pay to 36 cents an hour. Thank you. The delegation met with a worker in front of her home who made shirts for Van Heusen. She spoke about the low wages she received at the factory. She asked that her face be covered for fear of losing her job.
The money you earn is so little. You spend whatever you earn. You cannot buy anything because here a pound of beans costs 5 colones and rice is 60, maybe 50 colones. The only other things you can buy are cheese, cream, things like that, because they are cheaper, tortillas. And to leave something for the trip, it's not enough. And to leave something for the girl who takes care of the children so she can feed them during the day, the money is not enough.
I think the most important thing is to let their voices be heard. And, I mean, it sounds very basic, but that's really the key. I've seen how companies react to people who question, to people who write letters, and it seems like it's not very much, but it's everything to them.
Even though the odds are just so insurmountable, anyone who tries to speak out against these conditions is fired. Some of them are in danger for their lives, depending on what they're doing, and people are still doing it. I mean, what they're facing down here is so much tougher than what we're facing, and obviously the most important thing we can do to give them hope is to work in the U.S. and to actually support their campaigns and make sure that things actually change.
The students and the National Labor Committee met with human rights and labor leaders from several Central American countries to discuss how to best confront the problems in the sweatshops and ensure that workers are treated fairly and paid a just wage. The delegation learned that the problems are the same across the region. In Guatemala, where every attempt to organize in the maquila factories has been crushed, the minimum wage is 36 cents an hour. In Honduras, 43 cents. And in Nicaragua, 23 cents.
In these assembly factories, at least 80% of the workers are women, and 50% are single mothers. This puts the women in even a more vicious trap, because there are families that are dependent upon them if they lose their job, if they get denied the overtime. If they're ever fired and blacklisted, they're in real trouble because there's no savings, there's no safety net, there's no unemployment insurance.
When you are pregnant, what they do is give you more work. They force you to do even more work than you are supposed to. If you don't, then they start treating you badly, telling you that you are a coward. Even though I was pregnant, I often had to work until 5 in the morning. I was 7 months pregnant and I had to work all night. And 3 times a week I stayed until 10 at night. There they would give you a motel room in order to sleep, but they would put 4 or 5 people in each room. And in each room there was only one bed, so I thought it was better to go back home. We talked about them giving us some kind of transportation to bring us home, because the area we had to go through is very dangerous. There was a case in which the people of Dual 3 had to work until 10 at night, and the next morning a girl was found dead. She had to work until late at night and didn't want to go to the motel and preferred to go home.
The delegation met another worker named Daisy, who invited them to spend the day with her. Daisy's house was a 40-minute walk to the main road, where she could pick up a flatbed truck to ride the rest of the way to the factory. To get to work by 7 a.m., she had to get up every morning at 4:30. Daisy was beaten and fired when she returned from her maternity leave. She was told it was because she was having too many children. At that point, she had been working at the factory for 5 years. Among the labels she worked on was Gildan, which produces t-shirts for the University of Kentucky and other schools. When they visited Daisy, both of her children were sick and medicine was far beyond her reach.
I entered and went to the station where I worked, and I put down my bag and sat against the two machines. Suddenly, I felt a blow to my head with a pistol. I tried to get up, and the pistol fell to the ground. She grabbed me by the hair really hard, and my head was dizzy from the blow. They fired me, and I've been working there for 5 years, and it's not right that they would not even give me my severance pay. And now I'm on the outside, and the guards continue to harass me, saying that if I don't keep quiet, she will hire someone to kill me. Well, now my job is making candy. I leave here early in the morning to sell it over there at the factory to all the workers.
The delegation tried to get into a factory in the free trade zone where Daisy worked, but they were thrown out within minutes. Each refusal, each time the delegation was not allowed to see the conditions firsthand, reinforced their understanding of the need for full public disclosure of factory locations and truly independent monitoring.
The whole system of globalization and of contracting, which is creating all these maquilas and these free trade zones, is to, as much as possible, keep the stuff locked behind these gates, behind these armed guards, behind the barbed wire, and to not let that get out.
They met with workers from a factory where Liz Claiborne clothes are made. The workers, who were afraid to be identified, explained the problem with the current monitoring system.
A commission from Liz Claiborne came to the factory and spoke to workers, 8 people all at one time, and asked them how they were treating us, if there was mistreatment, if they screamed at us, if they were pressuring us, and they all said no, because there in the office, in front of the Korean managers, the people could not say anything.
That night, they went to a safe house far out in the country for a secret meeting with workers, two of whom had just been illegally fired from the Caribbean Apparel Company, where they sold clothing for Walmart's Kathy Lee label and for Kmart and Leslie Fay. Giovanni Fuentes, a young union organizer, was assisting the women in their struggle to end the abuses and to gain their basic rights. When this clandestine meeting was later discovered, 4 more workers were fired, and Giovanni Fuentes received death threats. He was told he could be killed for 100 colones, about $12.
Then I went to work in the American Park Free Trade Zone, and I've worked there for 1 year as of August. I was fired on the 9th of August of this year. The Korean managers there really mistreated the sewing operators. We were not allowed to go to the social security clinic. They didn't allow us to get up to go to the bathroom during working time. The drinking water they gave us was hot. There was no cold water. The heat was excessive because there were no fans, and the eating areas were very dirty.
The companies will not let anyone enter their factories to see the conditions inside. If you try to get in, they stop you and call the police.
Do they make any of these clothing?
¿Ustedes han visto esta ropa? ¿Han visto estos estilos de Catilí?
Sí, se ha hecho bastante.
Yes, we've made a lot of these.
Está en la línea de nosotros. Sí, esta se trabajó en la línea.
Yes, we did this on my line.
But it's Catilí.
Sí, en Catilí.
Yes, in Catilí.
In El Salvador, with these 225 factories, the 70,000 workers, there's not one single union with a contract in any of those factories, none. Despite the pregnancy tests, despite the forced overtime 15-hour shifts, despite the starvation wages, despite the locked bathrooms, the humiliation, the yelling and screaming at the women, despite all the maltreatment, there's not one single union in the entire country in the maquila. Why? If the workers are even seen meeting, they're fired. If the workers are seen grouping together by the company gets nervous and they're fired. If they're suspected of actually organizing to learn their rights and defend their rights to organize a union, they're fired and blacklisted and they're kicked out onto the street with nothing.
It is important to organize, and not only in Dual, but in all the maquila factories. They should organize a union, someone who can represent us, because Dual is not the only place where there is mistreatment. It happens in the majority of the factories.
After being turned away from one Nike factory, the delegation decided to try their luck again. They saw workers being searched as they headed across the street to eat their lunches. They talked to the workers while they ate, but soon discovered that since the workers thought they were corporate monitors, they were afraid to speak honestly about the factory conditions. They said things were fine, except that the wages, while legal, were not enough to take care of their children. The delegation decided to enter the factory as the workers streamed back inside from lunch and see for themselves. It wasn't long before management spotted them and rushed to violently confiscate their film.
The camera. Give me your camera, please. I don't want to use the board.
Hey, wait. You don't have any authorization to be here.
The door was wide open.
No.
That's my clothes.
What are you
Those
doing?
Are my clothes.
No, this is not your clothes.
Where's your camera? Let's leave. Don't touch the wall.
Okay, why?
Okay? Because I'm telling you, so that's why.
Give me your camera. Give me the other camera.
We don't care. We need this film.
I need the other video.
I need to check.
Be a little civil.
This is like a Gestapo camera. You have to be a little bit calm and a little bit civil.
Did you guys get punched?
Well, we got some of us got our arms knocked when they took the camera. They ripped the film out. After about 10 minutes in there, they had 10 or 15 guys on us.
I tried to take my video camera. I just hung on to it.
They were
but
very.
But I had to give them the tape, and they were still. Shotgun.
I think it's made pretty clear to me that these companies, when given free rein, will do anything in the name of profit, that we cannot rely on them to treat their workers with dignity as human beings.
It was so incredibly violent, and I wonder, well then, you know, how can they treat the workers? They obviously don't have respect for any kind of civil liberties whatsoever.
Every experience we've had today is really, really clear that Nike and these other corporations have a tremendous amount to hide.
The only way to put a human face on the global economy, the only way to make trade fair, is to condition it upon respect for human and worker rights. No country, no corporation should gain unfair competitive advantages through exploiting child labor, firing pregnant women, forcing people to work 15 and a half hours a day, paying them starvation wages, and then firing and blacklisting them every time they try to defend themselves or organize a union.
It is an important support that you are giving us, making the companies respect our rights. Because even though we are doing everything that we can here, we cannot do it alone.
If you think of the worst nightmare of the major corporations, it's that young people will start to ask serious questions about where this stuff is produced, you know, under what conditions, By whom? How old are the workers? What are they paid? Is that a living wage? Are their rights respected? And that's exactly what's happening across the country. And it has the companies enormously nervous. The students are in a position of enormous power, and they're operating, I think, with tremendous effectiveness. And it's going to make a huge difference.
The National Labor Committee says, to help end child labor and sweatshop abuses, you should tell the companies, one, to stop hiding sweatshops and to publicly disclose the names and locations of their factories, two, to open their factories to independent verification by local, respected religious, human rights, and labor organizations, not by corporate firms like PricewaterhouseCoopers, three, to respect the right to organize and pay a living wage. You can contact the National Labor Committee by calling 212-242-3002. University students should contact United Students Against Sweatshops at 202-NO-SWEAT. High school students should contact the Student Committee Against Labor Exploitation at 212-242-3002.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end, for my guns and my